Shift gears and get into the Einstein equation. So I'd like to distribute these notes first. Now, there is a very large amount of material in these notes. What we're going to be focusing on today is the rather ugly task of taking Einstein's equations, which fundamentally are written in this very beautiful four-dimensional tensor notation, and decomposing them, sort of undoing this marriage of space and time into space-time, and writing them in a form in which time has been singled out so that we can proceed and solve the equations as a dynamical system. And that necessarily brings in a lot of tensor analysis, and the details are complicated, so we're not going to go through all the details. What I'd like to do is sort of hit the high points and certainly define all the relevant concepts and notation that we'll be using. But before we do that, I'd like to just maybe have you think about this for a minute. Say that you know about Newtonian gravity, and somebody else knows about Newtonian gravity, and you've considered it from the point of view of a field theory. Okay, so that you understand that, basically you can sum up Newtonian gravity in terms of a Poisson equation that says that gravitational potential phi satisfies a Poisson equation, which in appropriate units, the right-hand side is the 4 pi rho, where this is the energy density. So you've all had some general relativity now, correct? Everybody, you've all had a class. So if you were to try to explain to somebody what the difference is between Newtonian gravity and general relativity, how would you do that? There's a couple of key differences. So if we think, I'll give you a hint. If we think in terms of potentials, for example, what do you think of one of the differences between Newtonian theory and any relativistic theory of gravitation has to be?
Well, the Newtonian theory of gravity describes the potential, whereas a relativistic theory describes the geometry.
Okay, that's true, but let's forget about geometry for a second, and let's go back and think about that potential, okay? So, any thoughts?
Yes, sir. Well, a change in the mass distribution in Newtonian gravity will instantaneously change the potential everywhere.
That's certainly one of the differences, but again, let's think in terms of that potential. How many potentials are there? It's not a trick question. How many are there?
One.
So what do you think a relativistic theory of gravity would say about that?
It's not enough.
Yeah. Why is it not enough?
Oh, because you don't just have rho, you have all the things in the stress energy.
Well, in particular, what should the right-hand side be rather than a scale?
Stress energy?
Well, probably not, right? Well, how would we generalize, what's the natural concept which is associated with any particle rather than just its mass? What's the fundamental thing in special relativity?
Momentum.
The four momentum. It's a four momentum, right? And the energy is simply a component of that four momentum. So the first thing that happens in general relativity, or any relativistic theory of gravitation, is instead of one potential, you're going to have four potentials. Okay? So that's one complication. And then the other complication is precisely, or the one difference is precisely what somebody pointed out, that, you know, there's no instantaneous, no instantaneous propagation of signals, right? So in some sense, the potentials still have this kind of instantaneous propagation, but the true information in the gravitational field, changes in the curvature, are propagated through radiation, which is completely analogous to gravitational radiation, which is completely absent in Newtonian theory. So in addition to having those four potentials, what you end up with in the general relativistic case is two wave fields, essentially. So at a very kind of crude but in some sense important fundamental physical point of view, you can think of general relativity as sort of being, you know, four copies of Newtonian gravity, because you have this four potential with Maxwell theory grafted on, because it really is the same polarization structure, if you will, that you get in Maxwell theory. Namely, there's two polarizations. Okay, and that's unique among, or relatively unique amongst general relativity as a relativistic theory of gravitation. Other theories which have relativistic theories of gravitation, which have waves, have additional polarizations. Okay, so that's just in the way of background. So, you know, numerical relativity is concerned with the time evolution then of initial data, and so we have to proceed with this, again, rather ugly task of decomposing the nice space-time approach into a space plus time approach. And so once more, I'm going to go through these notes and just sort of hit the high points, but the notes sort of separate into two pieces. There's one which emphasizes coordinates and component forms of tensor expressions. And when it comes right down to it, for driving the partial differential equations, which eventually we have to do in order to then solve them using finite difference techniques, this is the approach which you sort of use on a day-to-day basis. However, it's also useful to try to understand how this decomposition works from a coordinate-free or a tensor point of view, and that can certainly be done. Now, when you're going through this coordinate-free approach, at times the derivations and the analysis are a little bit more complicated in some ways than they need to be relative to the sort of the straightforward coordinate-free approach. But it's important to, if you're going to become, you know, a practitioner in general relativity, to be able to work with both sorts of formulations. And the coordinate-free approach, where you think in terms of tensors and geometric objects, is extremely useful, you know, for analyzing what you need to look at physically and also in making progress from time to time in coming up with new formulations of equations and things like this. But the key point is eventually you have to introduce a coordinate system to numerically generate a space-time, so you can't stay with a coordinate-free approach. Okay? You have to lay down some set of coordinates, and in fact, this is a tricky point because nobody tells you how to do that. You have to construct the various geometrical quantities in that coordinate system. In the end, you want to make sure that the physics that you extract does not depend on the coordinates you've chosen, and that's also very, very tricky, but operationally, you need that coordinate system. So the ultimate goal is to reformulate the Einstein equations. Okay, so just a note, so Ruth Gregory taught the general relativity, is that correct? So she must have done abstract index notation. You guys are all familiar with that? That when I write these Latin indices, they're not to be viewed as components of a tensor. This, the fact that G has these two subscript Latin indices, A, B, says that it's a rank 2 tensor with of type 0, 2, so the indices are covariant, okay? And so those indices are part of the definition of the fact that this is a tensor. You can then do all sorts of manipulations in tensor calculus, sort of treating them as if they're the same kind of, treating them as if they're coordinate indices to do the manipulations, but fundamentally, you're not to think of these as components. Okay, so this is a tensor, and this is a tensor, and you can tell the rank of the tensor by the number of indices on it. Okay, so we don't have to worry about this this little shift in perspective here. I need to be careful here.
What did you write there in front of the TAV?
Oh, sorry, that's 8 pi. You're going to have to get used to my scrawl. You don't usually get into problems, but the thing is that you want to think of the object, you know, as this rank 2 tensor, okay? So you can, for example, you can write down something like, and we will, you know, take something like TAB, and contract that with a vector NA, and that yields a covector, okay? But you don't have to think in terms of going into a particular coordinate system and doing the sum over those components, right? So this is this notion of abstract tensor. So this tells you how you compute that vector, right? It is that contraction, but the fact that it has one free index tells you immediately that that's a vector, okay? So that's the beauty of the notation. To convert it into the component form, all you do is, you know, change the kind of indice or reinterpret the index as actually representing the components. So it's really a case of interpretation. Okay. So the fundamental point of view we want to adopt is that, again, geometry of space-time, this is important. The curvature of the space-time determines the gravitational effects. And so we want to understand the curvature, but rather than viewing the space-time as a whole and having some sort of overall geometry, we now want to view that geometry as being the time history of the geometry of a three-dimensional surface. And that's the view that we'll adopt. Okay? So the fundamental quantities in dynamical general relativity then relate to the geometry of a three-dimensional surface. And it's the time history of that geometry that then becomes the geometry of the space-time. And one of the complications is that there's no unique notion of what time should be. For a general curved space-time, there's not even any preferred notion of what time should be as there is in flat space-time. So you have ultimate flexibility in how you want to, if you, as it were, slice up the space-time into this set of surfaces, okay? And that is basically equivalent to your choice of a time coordinate. So we recall that general relativity doesn't really have a formal symmetry group, but there's this group of invariances, the equations of motion or tensor equations, and they're covariant under general coordinate transformations. And there's 4 degrees of coordinate freedom. You have to choose a coordinate system. And so we're going to proceed as follows. Our space-time is a 4-dimensional manifold, space-time manifold that has a Lorentzian signature with a metric G, A, B, and the metric, our signature convention is minus, plus, plus, plus. And we will introduce coordinates, X mu, this is actually a T, and then there's 3 spatial coordinates, X, I. So when we're talking enumerating specific coordinates, and when we're talking about indices of tensors, we'll use these 2 sets of indices. So the Greek indices will always go over the space-time values, 0, 1, 2, 3, 0 being the time, whereas Latin indices in the range I, J, K, L, M, and N will go over only the spatial values, 1, 2, and 3. We'll reserve Latin indices from the beginning of the alphabet, A, B, C, D, etc., to be these abstract indices on tensors. And there's a summation convention on both kinds of indices. Now, once we've introduced that coordinate system, at least implicitly, because again, numerical relativity is concerned with the construction of space-times, and so you actually have to lay down the coordinates as you construct that space-time. But assuming that we've, in principle, you know, we can visualize the space-time that we're going to generate from given initial data, and we can cover that with some coordinate system, T and XI, then we want to make sure that the t equals constant surfaces really correspond to what we would mean by an instant of time. And sort of what we mean by an instant of time then is a three-dimensional surface such that no 2 points on that surface can communicate with one another, you know, through causal propagation of signals. So that means that any separation on that surface has to be space-like, with what in our convention means that the displacement has to be positive, okay? So that's what we'll mean by an instant of time. So if we have these coordinates, if we have 2 events which have coordinates t and xi and t and xi prime, then the distance between those 2 points, and in general, if they're not infinitesimally separated, we'll have to integrate that, is going to be greater than 0. And you really should be viewing time as a parameter. Okay? So the time that we introduce, that time coordinates, in general, won't have any real physical significance. It'll just serve as a way to label what these surfaces are. It'll provide us the means of advancing our solutions, but it won't, in general, have any physical meaning, or direct physical meaning. So a surface of constant time we will denote by sigma, so sigma of t then, labeled by t, it's a differential manifold in its own right. Okay, so we have a four-dimensional manifold, we take a slice, you know, we have a differential manifold then at any constant time. So it has a metric on it, which is a three metric. And so I'll adopt this notation in which there's this superscript 3 in parentheses before the metric to emphasize that it's defined on the three-dimensional surface. Okay? So it's three-dimensional and it's symmetric. So recall that if I use these parentheses around a pair of indices, that means I've symmetrized. So in other words, I've taken gij plus gji and a half of that. And if I use the square brackets, that means I've anti-symmetrized over those indices. So the four-dimensional metric actually induces that three-dimensional metric on the surface. Okay? So that's the first thing. The other thing is once we've introduced this time coordinate, and so we now have this concept of these slices which fill the space-time, there's a natural vector field that we can define, which is simply the normal vector, okay, to these surfaces. Now, you can easily show, it's a good exercise, that if you're in four dimensions and this is a space-like surface, then this normal has to be time-like. Okay? So that normal is time-like, we choose it to be pointing to the future, and we normalize it. Make sure that its length is -1, because it's a time-like displacement. And that's what we'll define to be this vector field n mu. Okay? So that's naturally defined once we have that set of slices. Okay? So the next part here is very important. So you should all be able to reproduce this construction, because this is really at the core of the separation of space-time into space plus time in the 3+1 language. So we have a surface here, constant time surface, sigma of t. And here is a nearby surface, sigma of t plus dt. And what we want to do is rewrite the space-time displacement in space plus time form. So we consider two events, p and q. P has coordinates x mu, which are t and xi. Q has coordinates x mu plus dx mu, which is t plus dt xi plus dxi. And so from the four-dimensional perspective, we can immediately write down what the displacement is. It's the square of the displacement is just g mu nu contracted with dx mu dx nu. Okay? And that's this distance denoted here. So what we want to do is essentially write down a generalization of the Pythagorean theorem in four dimensions. So we'll break the displacement up into a time-like part and a space-like part. So again, once we've defined the surface, then we have this notion of normal propagation. So here's a normal connecting this surface with that surface. Okay. And in general, if we imagine an observer traveling along that path, that infinitesimal path, there will be some infinitesimal lapse of proper time for that observer. Okay? The lapse of proper time for that observer, namely how many, you know, heartbeats, a fraction of a heartbeat, you know, his or her heartbeats in that interval, will not, in general, be directly correlated with the coordinate time, but it will be defined, and therefore, all we need is one function to express the ratio between the coordinate time and the proper time. That function is known as the lapse function, because it defines the lapse in proper time for an observer who's moving normal to the hypersurface relative to normal propagation. So with normal propagation, relative to the coordinate time. Yeah, Eric.
Does this mean that the normal points exactly in the increasing p-direction?
Yes, it does. No, it's not aligned in general with the vector that you would associate with the time coordinate, okay? So NA is not, for example, so using the abstract index notation, so this is the vector that one would associate with the time coordinate. This is not true in general, okay?
Line from P to, that's not
normal to the surface. Yes, it is. Okay? But it's not necessarily the direction of this vector. We'll get to that later. Yeah?
Because
you're alpha dt. Yeah. So, sorry. That's the lapse in proper time.
Okay.
Right? And it is given by alpha dt, so it's linear in dt for small dt, infinitesimal dt, but we need a function to define this translation between proper time and coordinate time. Was there another question? Yeah.
Yeah. Are we doing this all in flat space-time?
No. This is curved space-time.
So I don't understand how we can take the difference of two space-time points then.
Well, the infinitesimal displacements. Okay. Yeah. All this is done in the limit that these displacements come in. Okay, so now we take a look at the second surface, the nearby surface, and we consider this intermediate point, P prime, because the observation is this. We have some spatial coordinates, xi, tied to this point, P, but if we go up normally here, there's no reason to demand or expect that the coordinates, spatial coordinates up here will be xi, because we essentially have complete freedom to smoothly transform the spatial coordinates as we go from slice to slice. In general, to get to a point, P prime, which has those same spatial coordinates, we'll have to shift those coordinates. And again, for smooth coordinates, that shifting will be proportional to dt. But in order to describe it, because we have three spatial directions, we need a vector. And this is the so-called shift vector. So it describes how the spatial coordinates are flowing from surface to surface relative to normal propagation. Okay? So we have that increment, we have that increment, and then finally up here we have the spatial increment dxi. Okay? So now we can put everything together and make the identification with the four line element. So the distance from infinitesimal distance from P to Q squared then is simply G mu nu dx mu dx nu, which is ds squared, but it's also equal to minus alpha squared dt squared, so that's the time-like displacement with a minus sign outside because it has to be because it's space-like. And then on the three surface, we have the shift part, beta I dt, and then the dxi part. Okay, and the distance in the surface is determined by the metric in the surface, by the 3 metric, the 3GIJ. So we have that expression, and then we can expand that out so we get a term dt squared here. So we collect that term, and we have minus alpha squared plus 3GIJ beta I beta J dt squared, and then we have a cross term, and then finally we have this purely spatial displacement on the free metric. Yes, Chris?
What is that fat superscript on ds?
That's a 4.
Okay,
so that's, you know, a fundamental equation. And again, the nomenclature, alpha is a lapse function, beta is a shift vector. So together, those are 4 functions. And those are precisely the description of the coordinate freedom of general relativity in the 3 plus 1 approach. And From that approach, one derives dual views. So the first point is, it's because they encode the coordinate freedom, they're essentially arbitrary. As long as they generate a space set of space-like slices with, you know, smooth coordinates, and that smoothness is basically for convenience. You could, if you want, you know, have some kind of weird coordinate system that jumps discontinuously, you know, and you could still, in principle, do the physics, but it would be usually quite difficult. Okay, but, you know, apart from that, those sorts of considerations, these are essentially arbitrary functions. Okay, so that's one view. But the dual view is that you have to somehow prescribe them when you're constructing a space-time. Nobody's going to tell you a priori what you should choose for alpha and beta. Okay? So you have the freedom to do it, but then when you're actually constructing the solution, you have the responsibility. You have to fix it somehow, or else you won't be able to proceed, because you won't know the precise form of your differential equations. And again, you know, when you're doing something computationally, all these details matter. You need to fix the coordinate system by giving at least some prescription for choosing the lapse and the shift. Okay, another point is that tensors, in this case a vector such as beta I, which are defined on the surfaces, these are called spatial tensors. So the three metric itself is a spatial tensor. It has an associated inverse with indices upstairs, okay, which satisfies the following relation. Right? If I contract the components, in this case, the J indicates the contraction, then I get the delta symbol, delta IK. And indices on three tensors will be raised and lowered with those metric components. Okay, so I can rewrite that equation above as, rather, I can get rid of the GIJ and write that as a contraction beta I, and similarly here I can lower that index on the shift vector, give the components of the shift one form, so beta J DXJ. And then a GIJ here. And so identifying with the general four-dimensional form, so here's the four-dimensional metric. I view the, if I'm looking at it as a matrix of components, then essentially I have a 1 by 1, a 1 by 3, a 1 by 3, and a 3 by 3. So G00 is given by alpha squared plus beta k, beta k. These covectors are simply given by beta j. And the GIJs are exactly the same as the spatial components of the four-dimensional metric. Okay? And that's actually a very useful observation, which generalizes. And it, you know, it's not immediately obvious until you do this sort of thing that you get that kind of result. So again, we take the four-dimensional metric and we look at the spatial components, the purely spatial components, and those are identical to the three metric. Okay? And that turns out to be a general principle. If you look at the spatial covariant components, that is, take a general tensor in four dimensions, make sure all its indices are downstairs, okay, then those components will be exactly the same as the components of a three tensor, which is defined on the surface. Okay, it doesn't work for the upstairs components, always for the downstairs. That's right. And in fact, it's a general principle for any embedding. Okay, that the covariant components will immediately be identified with covariant components in the reduced manifold. So you can understand how that comes about by recalling that from the geometric point of view, components of covariant tensor components are defined by the action of the tensor on vectors. On the basis vectors. So that's how things work. You have this general view of a tensor as being an operator, you know, a map on vectors. And if we map, take the general tensor, say T, a four-dimensional tensor, a symmetric of type 0, 2, so it has two indices downstairs, then the components T mu nu are defined by the action of T on the basis vectors E mu, E nu, where I put this little vector symbol over the E to emphasize that each one of those is a vector, and the mu here is not a component index, it labels which vector I'm talking about. Right? So each one of these is a geometrical object. If mu is zero, it's the time vector, ijk, it's the spatial vectors. Okay? And similarly, in the three-dimensional case, for the covariant spatial components, then, we simply have to consider the action of T on a pair of spatial coordinate vectors, basis vectors, I should say. But those four-dimensional spatial coordinate vectors, basis vectors, are precisely the coordinate basis vectors 3EI for the surface, sigma T, with coordinates XI. In other words, you know, if you just consider the spatial coordinate basis vectors, those span the induced the surface sigma t is equal to constant with constant time. Okay? And that's not true for the one forms. So the basis one forms, if you restrict those, if you consider only the spatial basis one forms, those will not in general be identical to the one forms in the three-dimensional surface. Okay, but it's a fact that we can identify a subset of the basis vectors in four dimensions as being the same basis vectors that span the surface in three dimensions, that we have that principle that components, spatial components of a four-dimensional tensor will always be identical to those components of a three tensor. Yeah?
But, so these basis vectors, are they the vectors that are tangent to the surface?
They're tangent to the coordinates. Yeah, and they are tangent to the surface. They all live in the surface.
But
the three.
But the dx's are not.
They still live in the surface, but in general, if you take the four-dimensional ones and take the subset, the spatial subset, right, and then go to the three surface and consider the coordinates there, construct the vectors, and then construct the dual basis, right, you'll find that those spatial dual vectors do not match up with the spatial components in the four-dimensional case. Yeah?
This is just a result because the way you edit the spatial is by identifying normal basis vectors, essentially. Right? It's because you pick the basis, or you pick the basis vector, which is normal, and then you pick three others around it.
That's right.
And that's what
right. Yeah. Okay, so,
So can you tell me whether the following thing is saying the same thing as what this says? So you take any four manifold and slice it up into time slices, and then choose coordinates so that the tangent, sorry, choose coordinates on each time slice so that they all flow together smoothly, and that the coordinate, you know, coordinate change vector is tangent to the time slice everywhere, then you can specify any metric by choosing, you know, in those coordinates. Sorry. So you've chosen the coordinates so that you have, like, this time that labels which slice you're on.
Yeah.
And then on each slice there are spatial coordinates.
Yeah.
And any metric in those coordinates can be written as the matrix given here.
Sorry.
So, like, are the shift vector and the lefts important? Because
no, I mean, because this applies to any tensor, right? So the observation is basically once we lay down this coordinate system, and the coordinate system, and we've chosen a basis compatible with that set of coordinates, right, and a four-dimensional basis, that the spatial components, spatial elements of that basis, span the subspace.
Okay.
And that there's nothing more to it than that, right? Really. Right, so the three-dimensional coordinates, you know, label the T equals constant slice. So it's the same, you know, assuming that it's the same coordinates being used in the four-dimensional case and the three-dimensional case, the same spatial coordinates, then the vectors you construct are going to be the same. But it's not the case for the one form, because they're defined with respect to different metrics. So, in particular, you can see that if you consider the contravariant components of the four metric, for example, and I leave this as an exercise for you to show this. So g mean u upstairs is minus 1 over alpha squared, beta j over alpha squared, beta I over alpha squared. But the ij components of the 4 metric are given by the ij components of the 3 metric minus beta I beta j divided by alpha squared. Right? So you can't identify the spatial components of the tensor with its indices upstairs with the corresponding spatial components of the 3 metric. Okay. Another result which is useful, one can work out from that previous expression, is that the negative of the root of the determinant of the 4 metric, and then take the square root of that, is simply alpha times the square root of the determinant of the 3 metric. Okay, now we want to go back and look at that normal vector field and figure out how we can write that down in terms of these new functions that we've introduced, the Laplace and the Schepp. So here it's easiest to start with the associated dual vector field n with the index down. So n mu then are the components in our 3 plus 1 coordinate system of this one-form field. So let's remind ourselves of the geometrical interpretation of the dual vector field as nicely laid out in Misner, Thorne, and Wheeler, that you can think of those always, at least locally, as level surfaces of some scalar function. Okay, so it's the dual notion to the idea that a vector can be thought identified with an infinitesimal displacement. And so if we have a vector here, v, and a one-form df, then we think of this one-form as having, as being described by these level surfaces, where the density of the level surfaces is proportional to the magnitude of the one-form. So the surfaces are closer together, if I sketch it out, if the one-form has a larger magnitude. And then the inner product of that one form of the vector, which I denote using this angle brackets, again, this is Misner, Thorne, and Wheeler terminology, which in coordinates is v mu on df subscript mu, is the number of level surfaces that that vector pierces. Right? So here is df dotted into v, pierces two surfaces, and two times df, it would, starts piercing three. Well, two increments here, and it's piercing four increments there. Okay, so it'll be useful to think then, start by thinking of the n mu as being associated with these level surfaces. And this is a somewhat unfortunate notation. That means proportional. It's going to get confused with the alpha shortly. But we know, right, that the normal vector field n is proportional to dt, but we have that constant of proportionality coming in, which is simply the Laplace function. Okay? But that's basically what this normal is going to tell us, is sort of how densely the surfaces are packed locally relative to the one form dt. Okay? So it tells us that in component form, n mu can only have a time component, right? So we only have n zero, and then the spatial components are all zero. Yeah.
Sorry. So I don't see why n is proportional to dt. I think it's the same thing I was thinking before. Why is that proportional?
Well, because it's not proportional everywhere, right? It's just that there can't be any spatial components of this. And because the dt is basically the level surfaces, the t equals constant surfaces. And so whereas this cannot be true, right? This has to be true. Because that's exactly what you mean by the level surfaces of time, right? Basically this one form, has to be everywhere, if you will, timely.
But wouldn't that be true if the constant proportionality is just one? When it's flat?
That's one choice, right? And in that case, that is true, if you choose a regular time. But in general, that's not the case.
Okay, but the direction is the same, it's not the scale.
No, so this is the thing. You can have a time coordinate which has a time vector which is not normal to the surfaces.
But even at that point, if you're choosing anything normal, then it has to be the time.
It's a time-like direction, but it's not the direction which is associated with the time.
No, because you're not necessarily choosing t constant, you're just choosing any.
No, we're choosing t constant. Okay, but if you consider the trajectories of an observer, we'll get to a little better of an explanation, right, in terms of how we can generalize the our choices of time. But at this point, the level surfaces, t equals constant level surfaces, have to be sort of proportional to the one form. That's kind of important. Maybe just think about it for a bit. And if it's still confusing next day, we'll...
It's just kind of weird for me that this is not true, but this is true.
So again, it's a surface is naturally associated with a one form. Okay, you can construct a vector out of it, right? But the thing that generates it, if you will, is the one form.
So now I'm confused. You said n is not always proportional to dt. But not everywhere.
Locally, you know, it's proportional in the sense that it only has a time component. That's what I mean.
But it's. I'm sorry. dt is. Let's call that the.
DT has components 1, 0, 0, 0, okay?
Right.
As a one form, 1, 0, 0, 0. N mu has components N0, which is a function, 0, 0, 0.
Oh, wait a minute. Okay. But how is N related to the normal vector, to the surface?
Sorry?
How is N related to the normal vector?
N is the covector,
yeah.
Or the dual,
the form. The metric dual.
Right,
okay.
The metric lowers it.
Okay.
Okay. And that's the point. When we lower it, it only has a time component. Okay. And then from the normalization condition, the norm of n mu has to be 1 minus 1. Then we get that n mu is minus alpha 0, 0, 0, where we choose that sign so that n mu is future directed. Right? So the key thing is it's easiest sort of mnemonically and also to remember these things, to start with the one form, because there the component structure is simple. You have minus alpha 0, 0, 0. Okay? But now when we raise the components, with the 4 metric, we get the components n upstairs mu, we find that that's 1 over alpha minus beta I over alpha. Okay? So in general, this will have all 4 components if the shift vector doesn't vanish. Okay. Any other questions? It's fine. We take time going through this because, like I say, it's not straightforward because you're kind of disentangling space and time from space-time, and these are the key concepts that we want to absorb. All right. So the intrinsic geometry of a space-like hypersurface, sigma t, is described by the 3 metric. So that encodes all the geometric information that can be deduced by making measurements within the surface itself. But because that geometry is embedded in a 4 geometry, there's another notion of curvature which comes about. Okay, and the canonical way of describing that is as follows. So I consider this sheet of paper, and be good theorists, so forget about all sorts of kinks and wrinkles on it. We assume that that's perfectly flat. And then we assume we have flatlanders, little ants or fleas, and all we can do is go around and make little measurements on the surface of this paper. And so we set up really careful experiments, and we draw little circles, and we compute the proper circumference, and we compute the radius, and we make measurements, and we work and toil and toil. Your graduate students working for advisors, right? And so you come to the conclusion that this surface is flat, right? And I'm holding it up here, and I've embedded it in a flat way in the 3-dimensional space. Okay, so again, forget about the wrinkles. Now I'm going to do this fancy magic trick that I curl the paper up into a cylinder. What's happened to the surface as far as ants know? They can't tell. By making local measurements, there's no change in the geometry. From our point of view, though, obviously something is different. So how do we detect that something's different geometrically? You look at the change in the normals, right? So if we construct the normal vector field in this case, and look how it changes from place to place, nothing happens. But if we look at the normal vector field in this case, the normals are pointing out all over the place, then clearly they change. And in particular, if we go around this way, they change. If we go down that way, they're not changed. If we go down this way, they're not changed. Okay? So that notion of curvature, which depends on how some manifold is embedded in another manifold, is known as extrinsic curvature, to distinguish it from intrinsic curvature. And sometimes it's called the second fundamental form. Yes?
Well, I'm just trying to wrap intuition around the denizens of your flat line can't actually tell from local measurements that you've wrapped things into a cylinder.
It's not so important that they're wrapped into a cylinder.
To take your example.
I'm just worried that you're thinking on the fact that it's closed, okay?
No.
Okay, even like this, it would be the same thing. Yeah, okay. All right, so just imagine being there. I mean, that do the experiment. If you draw little circles on this piece of paper, then, you know, when I do this, apart from little stretching effects that we'll ignore, you know, in the fibers and stuff, the structure of that geometry doesn't change. The sheet of paper is still flat.
I guess the key is
still flat. Yes.
Okay. So,
you said we have flatlanders living on the sheet.
Yeah.
So, presumably the sheet, like, we seem to have like a natural time slicing in our universe.
Only from sort of a cosmological perspective. But say we're in the vicinity of two black holes which are colliding. I know it's kind of hard to imagine that, but there, let me tell you, there's no, as far as you know, natural notion of time.
Yeah, like, let's put it this way. My intuition tells me that if we were living in a universe in which if there's no natural notion of time slicing, what does it mean that a flatlander living in that universe can't tell that the time slice is curved? Like, the time slice is just something in your head, right?
Well, it's not so much that, but that there is a notion of curvature once you've embedded a manifold in another manifold,
right,
which cannot be detected within the manifold, within the submanifold. So in this case, the flatlanders cannot distinguish between this case and this case. Right? But there is a difference from the three-dimensional point of view, right? And that is deduced from looking at what happens to the normals. So I think we should probably just push ahead a little bit, at least, because I'd like to get through this section before we wrap up. So maybe we can leave that for a little bit later. So there's the example. So getting back to our four-dimensional case then, all we need to do is examine the changes in the normals from place to place, and that's done by applying the gradient, the derivative operator, I should say, to the normal, and then restricting it to the spatial slices. Okay, so this is the covariant derivative operator, which is compatible with the four metric. So that when we apply that to the four metric, it vanishes. I apply that to NJ, and I'm doing everything with the components downstairs, and then I throw in a minus sign. Again, that's just by convention. And that defines the components of the extrinsic curvature. Again, with their components all downstairs, the covariant components. And one can show that that's actually a symmetric tensor. So that's identically, you know, these expressions are identical. There's no anti-symmetric part to that tensor. Yeah?
So we've seen a formula like this before for Pij, but there were a bunch of H's in it.
Yeah, it probably comes from that particular representation of the free metric. We have been using H for the free metric.
Metric.
So again, I think if you go through, I'm going to have to leave it to you to go through the sort of second set of notes here. We go through things in the coordinate free approach and see where that expression comes from again. Okay. So there's many different ways you can write it down, but again, we're focusing on this one that's sort of pragmatic, if you will. It gets you to the by working with the components, it's sort of things you need to do when you're working with the partial differential equations. So you can sort of quickly see that it's symmetric. The easiest way, so if you go and you look at the gory details in the second part of these notes, the proof to show that this is symmetric is rather convoluted relative to the component approach when you do it for the abstract index approach. From the component approach, I can write down exactly what the components are here. Okay, so I first have the ordinary partial derivative acting on nj, and then I have this term involving the Christoffel symbols, so ij here and a sum over mu. But n mu is simply minus alpha 0, 0, 0, right? So this term identically vanishes because the nj identically vanishes, so I get that the extrinsic curvature components up to a sign are given by alpha times the four-dimensional Christoffel symbol. And I write down exactly what that is from the definition and work it all the way through. And in the end, I get three terms. Got spatial derivatives of these components of the four metric. But the interesting one, the one I want to focus on, is I get the four metric with its indices downstairs. So remember, that's just the three metric, and a time derivative of it. So that from a dynamical point of view, the extrinsic curvature components are sort of, not sort of, they really are the momenta associated with the three metric. So the extrinsic curvature is, if you will, a velocity of the three metric from the 3+1 point of view. Okay? And so when you think of in terms of the dynamics then, if you think about your Hamiltonian dynamics, P's and Q's, the three metric components are the P's and the extrinsic are the Q's, I should say. They're the positions, and the KIJs are the momenta. Yeah? It's okay.
Does that just make these formulas a lot more complex?
Absolutely. But this same, yeah, exactly. It all boils down to, you know, defining projection tensors and then doing the decompositions, right? So you could imagine even having more subspaces. So you might have a one-dimensional subspace and a two and a three, right? And so you just have to define various types of projections and then mixed kinds of projections. But you can carry through the whole formalism, and then various tensors will have the same kinds of decompositions, yeah. So, you know, you'll see analog sets of formulas in many different areas. Okay, so again, so one term that comes out of here is the KIJ is minus 1 over 2 alpha, and then we have this partial derivative of the GIJ, and then there's additional terms. So we can think of it as the velocity of the free metric or the conjugate momentum. Okay. So that's actually probably a pretty good place to start. I just wanted, there's a ton of notes here, and I'm not going to have time to go through them. So I just want to sort of hit some high points and show you, ask you to read through these before tomorrow, if at all possible. And we'll pick up tomorrow because we're going to have to get into the Einstein equations themselves, start writing them down in spherical symmetry. So I'll give an overview, but I just want to highlight, if you can sort of just put tick marks beside these equations that I'm going to highlight. So equation 4, where we define what this normal is, the one form. Okay, so this is all sort of, a lot of this is the discussion we've done today, but repeated in this abstract index form. Tau is the scalar function which defines the level surfaces, the t equals constant surfaces, and so Na is just given by minus alpha times grad A tau. Okay, and so that was this observation that in component form that tells us that n only has a component, has only a time component. Another important quantity is the acceleration associated by the normals, associated with the observers whose tangent vectors are the normal vectors. So these are observers that are moving orthogonal to the slices. And they, in general, will have an acceleration, which you can compute by taking the covariant derivative, applying it to NB, and then dotting that into NA. Okay? And in particular, recall, or you may not have probably have been told this, but the acceleration, the 4 acceleration, has a magnitude which is precisely the 3 acceleration that that observer would feel in his rest frame or her rest frame. Okay, so that's whereas the 4 velocity doesn't really have any direct relationship to 3 velocities, 4 accelerations do have magnitudes which are exactly the same as the 3 acceleration measured by an observer in the rest frame.
Do you mean the spatial part of
it? Nope, the overall magnitude. Right? That's a good exercise for you to work out as well. If the acceleration vanishes, then what kind of observers are these? They're moving along what?
Geodesics.
So that's an important observation. And then all these notes basically amount to figuring out how to do various projections of tensors and tensor equations, most notably the Einstein equations. So we have a normal vector, we have a surface. From the normal vector, we can construct a projection operator into that surface. We can consider components which are parallel to the vector and which are orthogonal to the vector. And basically all of this is just a lot of manipulation to do that various, those various projections. And so a little bit of notation, if we consider a vector field, a vector, WA, and we want to consider its component along the normal direction, then we'll denote that, and that's effectively one number, we'll denote that by W with an N hat. And so again, that's not a, it's a sort of an abstract index, but it's not a regular kind of index. That just means we've taken a vector and we've dotted it with NA. And we introduce that minus sign. That's a convention. It's York's convention. It's adopted throughout these notes, so be careful with that. On the other hand, if we do the opposite kind of contraction, so we take a dual vector field and we dot it with the normal rather than the dual, then we'll call that a W with N hat downstairs, but the sign is plus there. This projection tensor is used a lot. Okay, so, and bear in mind that these A, B indices, everything here is being done in 4 dimensions. But if you sit down and you work things out in component form, you'll find that there's a lot of zeros floating around, right? So you sort of carry along some extra baggage to work everything out in 4-dimensional form here. And again, some of the calculations are rather longer than if you'd just taken a coordinate approach. But nonetheless, it's good to see that everything can be done in the 4-dimensional covariant approach. So the projection tensor is simply delta AB plus NANB. If we were in a metric that had Riemannian signature, so it was plus, 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 you would expect that projection operator, of course, to have a minus sign. But because we're projecting in a time-like direction, it's a plus here. Okay? And an important property is that so when we write a projection operator with this perp symbol without anything in front of it, then what we mean is that we project all the free indices. So in this case, it's simply that index. And of course, this comes out to be 0, as it better be, because that's why we construct it, so we could get things that are orthogonal to the vector field. So again, if I write perp in front of this, it means I've projected out every index. If we project the metric itself, okay, so if we just lower the definition of the perp, we get the metric in the surfaces, and rather than using that subscript 3 form, I adopt the convention, which is standard in our field. This is called gamma AB, and that might be what you saw as HAB before. I'll check on that.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. We can define the natural operator, derivative operator associated with the 3 metric by projection. So this dA is effectively the covariant derivative operator on the surfaces, and you define that for projecting the four-dimensional operator. Once you have that four-dimensional operator, the three-dimensional operator, then you can define notions of curvature. So you can define the curvature, Riemann curvature tensor, most naturally defined in terms of its action on a dual one form, on a vector, dual vector, I should say, in this way. That's a purely spatial tensor. So if you can track any of those indices on the Riemann tensor, the three-dimensional Riemann tensor, that's going to vanish. Has the usual symmetries. And you can define the three-dimensional Ricci tensor, the spatial Ricci tensor RAB, and the Ricci scalar, spatial Ricci scalar R, in the usual ways. Here's the definition of the extrinsic curvature tensor. There's lots of derivation here. This is a useful result, that the acceleration one form AB is given by the three-dimensional derivative operator acting on log alpha. Right, so you see immediately that if alpha is a constant, then you've got geodesic observers. There's the definition of the KAB. Basically what we've seen already, the projection essentially means I just pick out the IJ components of this. Again, all I'm doing here is what I want to do is picking out sort of the high points. When we decompose a general symmetric tensor, we project that, a general symmetric tensor with its indices downstairs can be written as follows. First, we have the part which is completely projected. We have another part over here where we've projected the sigma. We've contracted in both cases with a normal vector NA and NB. Okay, so that's the term, the pure time part. And then we have this cross term. Again, this indicates symmetrization on the indices where one of the indices on sigma has been projected. Because that's for a general symmetric tensor. For the important case of the stress tensor, then this defines quantities basically known as the rest mass, the mass density, I should say, the momentum density, and the spatial stresses. And these things appear on the right-hand side of the projected Einstein equations. And you can interpret them physically. They will correspond to the energy density, the momentum density, and the spatial stresses that observers who are moving normal to the slices will measure. Okay. More derivation, lots of derivations. Quantity which is often appears in the 3 plus 1 equations is the trace of the extrinsic curvature tensor. So we just contract the extrinsic curvature tensor, and we get the scalar function. And then this is one of the Einstein equations. It's a so-called constraint equation because it doesn't say anything about dynamics. It basically, if you will, it corresponds to energy conservation. So this is the Ricci scalar. That's the square of the trace of the extrinsic curvature, and this is the square of that extrinsic curvature tensor. On the right-hand side, we have the energy density. So we'll come back to that equation. Similarly, there's a so-called momentum constraint, where essentially we take one covariant derivative acting on the KAB, and then a covariant derivative acting on the trace, and that's equal to 8 pi times the momentum density. And that's known as a momentum constraint. And again, it can be associated with the conservation of momentum in the theory. So those are four of the Einstein equations. I advocate that those of you who are having difficulties with this notion of why the time direction doesn't necessarily have to be normal, et cetera, that's sort of described in detail here. I want to point out that there's a discussion in here of Lie derivatives. So from the point of view of the derivation of these equations, you can look at Lie differentiation as being the natural generalization of the notion of partial differentiation or directional derivative. So in particular, if you consider the ordinary, the covariant derivative operator acting on a tensor, that always increases the rank of the tensor, right? Whereas a Lie derivative maintains the rank of the tensor, and it's associated with a vector field, okay? And in particular, once you've defined a coordinate system and you've adopted basis vectors, then the Lie derivative with respect to the time-like vector field, the time-like basis vector, is simply the partial derivative with respect to time, okay? So, a key expression here is the generalized time vector. So this is essentially, we can use a time direction which has a vector associated with it, which can be defined in terms of the normal NA by pre-multiplying by the lapse here and then adding in the shift vector. Okay, so it's only in the cases with alpha is equal to 1 and beta equals 0 that the time, the direction that's associated with that time coordinate is actually normal to the surfaces. Whoops, didn't want to do that. And so finally, we get to the dynamical content of Einstein's equations. As soon as I find them. Sorry. Here. Okay, so one of them basically follows from the definition of the KAB in terms of the Lie derivative of the normal field. So using that previous expression that I just flashed to you, how we define that time vector in general in terms of alpha and the shift, and using properties of Lie derivative, we can just rewrite that to say that, and again, when you see this L sub t, that's just going to turn into an ordinary time derivative when we write down the partial differential equations. That says, essentially, the ordinary time derivative of the three metric is equal to minus 2 alpha times extrinsic curvature plus some spatial derivatives of the three metric. Okay, and that's basically a definition of the KAB. So again, looking at it from the Hamiltonian point of view, that's the kind of evolution equation that says P is equal to Q dot. The dynamical, the real dynamical equation is a mess. The one that sort of, in some sense, encodes the gravitational wave propagation, for example. That one's just a definition. So, you know, so Newton's third law, if you will, right? The definition that P is equal to Q dot doesn't say anything about dynamics. It's the equation for P dot that matters. Okay, so this is the equation for P dot. So the time derivative of the extrinsic curvature tensor, you've got some spatial derivatives of the extrinsic curvature tensor, and then you've got various terms. So you've got second derivatives of the lapse, and then you've got the lapse times this mass. So you've got terms which are quadratic in the extrinsic curvature, terms which involve the stress energy components, but the real mass is here in the Ricci tensor. And as you'll hear in the third week, you know, largely because of the structure of that tensor, it essentially has arbitrary second derivatives of the spatial metric. This is one of the things that leads to the fact that a lot of the ways you could write down Einstein's equations as a dynamical system lead to non-well-posed or ill-posed problems. Okay, so we're not going to, of course, go through this derivation. Next day, we'll just accept these equations as God-given and then start looking at specific simple cases in spherical symmetry, work out the equations, and then finish up the week with a discussion of a specific model. Okay? Thanks a lot.